Welcome to Season 5, Episode 5 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk to James Winfield about 1D4Con. We debate the pros, cons, and other bits about house rules. And finally, we answer another fun listener question. Again, welcome to Season 5, Episode 5 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this week is Brian, now from Beer Star Games. And, of course, George is always with us and bringing fun wherever he comes.
Oh, I try.
You try. We try. We all try. Mm. So, anything before we just kind of hit into the news? Anything exciting before that?
No, the news is the exciting part. Let's do the news.
The news is the exciting part. Okay, sweet. First up, my favorite bit in the news, which I'm going to classify as, I understand collectibles, but this is kind of useless, the D&D White Box reprint. And I only say that out of love. I mean, trust me, I'm an old school D&D gamer, but I'm like, the D&D White Box, really? Yeah. From a historical aspect, sure. But for the price that WotC is trying to put on it, to be kind, they can go blow. No, that's not to say it's not nice. I mean, it comes in a wooden box. It comes with some dice.
And it comes with some setting material that was released outside the white box, right? That's my understanding.
Yeah, I think it does as well.
But some of the early supplements.
Yeah. It just doesn't come with chainmail. Oh. So... But still, it was kind of, it's just kind of one of those weird ones where it's like, I kind of understand it, and I'm kind of on the edge about it. I don't know if we may have even reported on this. I just tell people, I think this to me kind of sounds like WotC's search for more money.
even though
I know people will buy because they're like, wow, I've kind of always wanted those, or it's kind of a cool little collectible item. Mm-hmm. I understand that, but it's still, it's just like, okay, really?
I understand this one more than the 3.5 reprints. You can't get this anymore. So for nostalgia value, for, you know, people who have always wanted it but didn't want to download it illegally, then this is a great opportunity. They tried to flesh out the box a bit more. We know what this really comes down to is the fact that they're not supporting 4th edition anymore, and they need to have some sort of product pipeline. And these reprints are what it is right now. They're not for me, but I know that they're for certain people. I was kind of excited to see it, but I'm not going to buy it. It's too much money. If they had done a cheaper reprint, then I probably would have picked it up, and I'll probably pick up the PDF version when they push that out.
Yeah, interesting. The little note here is that they do include a special set of 10 red and gold dice.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, a D4, 4D6s, a D8, 2D10s, a D12, and a D20. Okay. Which actually, if they really wanted to make it more historically accurate, they should have made those, you know, had no D10s and just had the D20s with 1 through 10 twice, and then have one side one color and another side another color. You know, that's how the D10s used to work.
I did not know that.
Yeah. I mean, back in the old days, you used to get your... They actually were made by Game Science back then, too. Mm-hmm. You used to get your little Game Science die, and they'd have 1 through 10 on both, twice on the D20. So you'd have to take your crayon, color one, a lot of people would do black, and then the other side they do, like, red, or white and red or something. And so, like, the red was usually, like, 10 higher, typically, is the way I've always seen it. Of course, people's mileage may have varied, but... They wanted to get a little more historically accurate. There you go. But we're not into history. Especially when almost the rest of our news is nothing but Kickstarters.
Kickstarter!
So, first up, the Kickstarter, Kobolds Ate My Baby. The gentleman who actually released it decided that, hey, you know, I'm getting tired of these things just being photocopies with staples, effectively. It's kind of what he said in his intro. So... He has it out there. So if you're a fan or it sounds interesting, he's actually already reached his goal. He only went at $11,000, and he still has 28 days to go as of this minute.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of cool. I've never played it, but it's kind of it's always a fun thing to do. And let's see. In the next Kickstarter of the day is our buddies at Green Ronin. They're doing one for Freeport, the City of Adventure. And it is their version for the Pathfinder RPG.
Awesome.
So, yeah, that's kind of awesome. It's going to be a 512-page source book.
Now, was there a D20 version of Freeport? I feel like there was, but I'm not positive about that.
You know, the way they describe it is that they've kind of... I think there was. They kept doing additions and additions. It's like, because Freeport first existed, according to them, in their little module, for their 32-page module called Death in Freeport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been a lot of Freeport.
Yeah. So this is just, in many ways, this is kind of their latest, you know, version.
Mm-hmm. Google says that there was a D20 Freeport companion.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
But that's fine, because we want to be able to apparently play Freeport in every game system ever. You know, that was one of the Fate Core stretch goals that they hit. We're going to have the Fate Core Freeport as well soon. So
damn it, I want the damn... You know, Freeport Savage World Edition.
Are we sure it doesn't exist?
You know, I don't know. I did not bother looking that up because I was just like, okay, no, I'm not. No, I've gotten enough other Savage World stuff because I did do the Interface Zero.
There is a Savage Worlds version of the Freeport Companion.
That
you
doesn't
can buy it from Green Ronin's online store.
That does not surprise me. Not one bit.
This goes back to that version war rant from that I had 2 weeks ago. Everybody's freeporting.
You can well, it's Freeport, right? It's supposed to be. I mean, that's sort of its thing. Is it's like the most popular gaming city ever.
Yeah,
and they've pushed it to every system because of that. So, hey, the PDF is only $8, Jeff. Robert Schwab worked on it. I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, you know, $8 is not bad, but right now I'm spending $8 on other things.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, but yeah, you know, that's cool. And yes, we did finally get the publisher's name right. Sorry, that's a running joke with me.
All right.
So, yeah. And finally, kind of in the area of what I'm going to call as, I'm not sure about this one, is the Dice Shield. I don't know. Did you guys take a look at the link to that?
I haven't seen this one. No.
You should. It is actually kind of interesting. It is, in effect, it's a piece of plastic up on pegs. It's almost like a hexagonal bowl up on some pegs. So you can put it on top of things, roll your dice, and, you know, like if you have pieces, they can be underneath.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at a picture of it right now. I'm not sure why I want this thing to exist.
Well,
I feel like I'm going to have to move it constantly.
Yeah, I think so, too. And the only thing I can think of is that, you know, if you're certain game players, you want all your dice rolled in one location and them not to go off the table. That's the only thing I can think of.
I guess so. I feel like there's a lot of ways to do that.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, there's the classic dice tower.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a cup or something.
Yeah, dice tower, dice shoe, whatever you want to
call it. Slow down, Brian.
Oh, a cup? Well, you know.
You know, crazy thoughts over here.
Well, you know, when he empties his cup.
You know, it is kind of expensive. Their goal's $53,000.
Yeah, I don't know why that is. It seems like...
I mean, the goal...
That does seem... obviously, I just looked at this. I'm judging it on 10 seconds worth of information. I mean, perhaps it is the greatest thing ever, and I just don't understand why it's the greatest thing ever.
I do think it would be really cool if you were heavy. If you're very heavy into miniatures and you really want everything in the middle, fine. That's it.
Yeah, it falls under just one of those ones, and it was just something interesting that people can look at and go like, would I really want to support this? But yeah, they have 25 days to go, and they wanted $15,300
I don't know about this, guys.
I suspect they probably will not reach that.
But we wish them the best of luck.
The only interesting thing is there is that in, I forget, is that in one of their stretch goals or?
Are you talking about those Mistborn die?
No.
Oh, they're awesome.
Not that, but the strange version of Monopoly that you can get.
I saw that at the bottom there.
Which was Alan Turing apparently made his own version of Monopoly.
Okay.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, and I guess the diagram that they have, it has a strange little, across the center, it has a shortcut or something. I don't know how that actually works.
Yeah, it's like an extra stretch that from go to free parking.
And do you any of you guys know who Alan Turing is?
No.
He was the man for World War II computing.
Oh, cool.
You know, so... Very, 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 very interesting that that's in there. It's like, okay, that's kind of bizarre, but okay. So, but there you go. That's kind of, like I said, I'm going to put that in the realm of the weird for the Kickstarters. Mm. But
everyone should look at this just to look at it.
Yeah.
You should.
You know, because, you know, we're not doing it justice. You may decide that this is the greatest thing since, you know, sliced bread or, you know, pressed pants. So.
Well, you know, toward the bottom, there is that special limited promotion of, those Mistborn dice. And those, yeah. You know, they're cool science, I mean, sorry, cool fantasy novels, the Mistborn novels. And those dice are pretty badass. Apparently, they're the last four sets available, easily findable on the interwebs.
Huh.
So,
yeah. So that's kind of it's interesting. So we'll see where that goes in 25 days. How's that?
Yeah.
We'll do a follow-up report to let everyone know whether or not it actually got funded. And you put that the Conquering the Corsairs was actually funded, which we kind of knew was going to happen, correct?
We did. It seemed like it was going to happen, but I like to try to at least remember to follow up on the Kickstarters, especially when people come on our show. And so this is funded. They're heading towards stretch goals now. There's only a couple of days left, so when you... listen to this tomorrow, because I know you guys like to listen to our show. As soon as it comes out, you'll have a little bit of time left. You'll have 2 days left as of tomorrow to when this drops to fund the Conquering Corsairs. But yeah, it's there. You totally, there's no risk involved anymore. If you fund this game, you will get a bunch of pirate cards to play a piratey game.
And everyone likes piratey stuff.
Who doesn't like piratey stuff? Communists only.
Oh, I don't know about that. You know the British during the Age of Sail really did.
Oh, that's true. The British, care. Yeah.
Well, unless they were their corsairs, you know, or the ones with the letter of marks.
Yeah.
Privateers. There we go.
They didn't even like those guys. Who are we kidding?
You know, that's where Britain got a good chunk of change. So, and lastly, the big announcement. For you.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You're like, what announcement am I talking about?
I know. Idea. I was confused for a moment. That's right. Pulp, the game I've been working on for a really long time, is coming out this week. It's in the approval stages right now on DriveThruRPG. I have absolutely no reason to think that it's not going to be approved. We should see it any day now. If you want to find out a little bit more about the game, you can check out pulptherpg.com. The website is up. It's got a little bit of information there. And once it's approved on DriveThruRPG, I will be putting the full game up on the website as well, because it is being released under a Creative Commons license. I'm not going to make you wait for someone to see it. You will be able to download it directly from me. So that's super exciting. You should absolutely check out pulptherpg.com. Or if you don't want to check the website every day to see when it's out, you can follow Beer Star Games on Twitter at Beer Star Games. It's going to be a good time.
All right. So that's the name of your company, Beer Star Games?
Beer Star Games is the company, is my company that I set up primarily for tax reasons. And right now it's primarily there to support Pulp. But we do have some other plans for the future.
So. I was just curious for tax reasons for that like whole $5 worth of revenue you're going to get. Well, you know, because, you know, as we've said many times, you know, game design, game selling is a very narrow margin.
I don't know what you're talking about. I make so much money as a freelancer. It is totally worth the time I put into it.
Yeah, and your day job is. So, all right. Well, we have actually a very exciting guest today. We have Mr. James Winfield. Welcome, yeah. James. You actually do the 1D4Cast podcast. That is correct, right?
That is true, yes. Thanks for having me on the show.
And what's really interesting is we heard, actually you told us specifically, that you decided to start this convention, 1D4Con. And
it's kind of a play off the podcast, 1D4Cast, 1D4Con. So,
hey, you know what? Whatever works. I mean, if it has con in the name, we're there, right?
That's right.
But no, I mean, you know, what's interesting is I have always, the reason I wanted to have you on is I've always been fascinated by, you know, how conventions start, you know, how people bother to organize them. Why do they do it? For example, here locally in Phoenix, we have almost none, strangely enough, for a city that has a population that's about what is in the upper 10, you know, one of the top 10 cities in terms of population. And we have no dedicated game conventions. We have some conventions that have game elements in them, but we don't have a dedicated game convention. At one point, someone started a game convention, and it lasted about 2 years, and then I haven't heard anything else from it.
So, that's a shame.
It happens. I think maybe the people might have had unrealistic expectations.
Yeah, that's something I'm trying not to have.
I suspect I know what the answer is, but what was kind of your primary motivation for, you know, creating 1D4Con?
Well, I live about an hour, 15 minutes outside of Washington, D.C., and they have a lot of conventions there, but everything is mostly D&D or Pathfinder centric, and that's great. I love those games, but in the last year or two, I've become more of a narrative gamer, playing games like Dread, you know, other things like Mythender and Mouseguard and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I find that more fun for me. And when I go to conventions, it's always the same old, same old. I even went to Gen Con last year, and I was saddened by the lack of games. Because I was always told that, you know, Gen Con has all these things, and it's like the best convention in the world. It was a fun convention, but their game catalog was very limited for the size of that convention.
That's interesting. Not to get sidetracked, it's like, because I've been to Gen Con a few times. Limited in what way? Like the actual variety or?
The amount, actually, because you have everyone. I mean, obviously, there's like 45,000 people going to this thing, mm-hmm. or more. And then everyone clamoring to get into a game. They only have so many games because they only have so many people sign up to run them. And they fill out, you know, fill up like within hours of opening.
Sure.
Oh, I see what you're saying. There doesn't seem to be like enough games to support
people that are coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's that. Matter of fact, they're going to run into that again this year. I would almost guess when does the game?
The cutoff for submissions is the 15th.
Of which?
This month.
Really? To submit? Yeah, see, that's, I thought they did more, though.
I have it written down here.
Because it seems like the 15th.
3/15/2013, Gen Con event submission deadline.
Huh. See, so there's one of your problems right there.
It's a really early cutoff.
Well, that's kind of just because of the way they do things. So, but yeah. That explains your opinion there. I was just kind of curious.
Right. But the main reason I decided to do this is because, yes, I live outside of D.C., but there really aren't that many conventions in the area. Everyone that I've told that's a gamer that I don't know in this area has said, yeah, this area is long overdue for a gaming convention. And that's store owners and everything else, you know, that, that want to vend their wares and such. and it's just, I don't know. I was looking around and I saw that Fear the Boot has Fear the Con, and they're on their sixth year, and it's been fairly successful for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a great bunch of guys and girls, and they bring a lot to the community. And I thought, you know what? I've been to a lot of conventions. I think I should give back. So I wanted not only to start my own convention, I wanted to help broaden other gamers' horizons with these other games that I've started playing.
Well, that's really cool. Where the hell do you start? I mean, because it's
my gosh.
You know,
it's like planning a wedding.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, it's just like...
You need to come up with a date first. Then you have to find a venue that offers everything that you want for the best price you can get, because this is all coming out of our pockets.
Right.
And we're hoping that we can recoup most of it. We're not expecting to recoup at all.
Well, that's a good way to be, not expecting to recoup.
Right. So if we get... one of the questions you sent me asked me, you know, how do you know if you'll do another one? I'll do another one if we get our expected amount of people to show up and great reviews from them. The expected is about 75 people. That's the expected. It's very, very small.
I got news for you. George, you said you were going, right?
I am so going.
So you are.
Yeah.
So there's already one in 75. There you go.
There you go. There you go.
And if I can turn on the charm, I will bring friends.
Oh, hey.
He'll find homeless people to come.
No, I've got some buddies who game up here. I'm hoping to convince them to come down and stay at my parents' house, which is not too far from this con, to add to your numbers. I think it would be
That'd
fun.
That'd be great. That'd be awesome. No, I'm serious. We're not doing this to make money, obviously.
Well, I don't think any convention ever starts out that way. I mean, even Gen Con, from what I understand, I mean, it was in, I think, the basement of some building for a while.
I believe it, yeah. I mean, they've been on for 45 years, 46 now. Yeah. So, yeah. You always have to start somewhere. And you know what? The dream is maybe someday it'll become like that. But if it doesn't, I'm okay with that. I just want to bring fun to other people. Have a convention around that people can go to and say, you know what? I've never gamed before. Or, you know, I haven't gamed in forever because there's no reason. I have nothing around me. Well, here you go. We're less than 2 hours from most of the major cities in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which is very cool.
I know, George is out there, Philadelphia. So he's a little bit further than the 2 hour mark, but I do appreciate. Say what?
Just barely.
Oh yeah. but you're still right outside of it. And that the fact that you want to come down, is really, really awesome feeling. We're an upstart, you know, most people don't even know who we are. And that's fine because we're a podcast and even though we've been around for almost 3 years, you know, we're not like all over the place kind of podcast. We're very low key.
Trust me. I understand. But that actually does bring up one of the other questions that I actually sent you. It's like, how do you convince people to come? I mean, what kind of modes of, I guess, advertising is the word I would probably want to use here?
Well, there's a couple things. You got to offer some kind of incentive. So it's not much of an incentive, but the pre-registration price being lower than the at-the-door price kind of helps. The at-the-door price is $25 for all 3 days, and then the pre-registration is only $20. It's only $5, but, you know, $5 makes a difference
to
a lot of people. So
I was about to say, Gen Con's difference is only $10.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, that's not bad considering, I think pre-registration is $68 for Gen Con for 4 days, and it's 78 if you're when you're there.
Oh wow!
So,
yeah, I went as the VIG to get all that other like swag and stuff that they give.
Which I'm gonna ask an ancillary question. How is that? I just don't quite get that.
I actually enjoyed it. It was very nice. We got it all depends on what you care about.
Okay.
If you care about getting free stuff, it's not really free because you're paying like $300 to get this anyway. But you know, I'm sorry. Am I allowed to curse on here?
Yes.
Okay. my podcast, I can curse all over the place. I just need to make sure. So yeah, $300. Actually, I think it was $600 for the VIG, and then like another $100 per companion. And I went with my best friend, and we kind of split the cost, split the room, and all that kind of stuff straight down the middle. So it wasn't too heavy on one of us. We kind of shared the load.
See, that's where the companions make a little bit of sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I can kind of see that kind of.
Yeah, we split the swag straight down the middle. We both got early access into the dealer's room,
which is always cool.
Yep, the first day it opened, so he was happy because he got the new Iron Kingdoms game, and that sold out within 15 minutes of the doors opening.
Yep.
See, I think that's probably one of the biggest reasons that some people actually bother to get the VIG is because that way they get that little. It's not a lot of time, but it's just enough. If there was something that you knew was coming out at Gen Con, you can get it then.
Oh yeah, I think the VIG actually like sold out in like 10 minutes last year. I'm not sure how it was this year.
It sold out
quickly as well.
Yeah. So.
So I was like refresh.
Yeah.
So
okay, well, that kind of, I mean, are you doing any advertising? I mean, obviously we've mentioned it on the podcast. We're having you on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that other podcasts are wanting you guys to do some sort of bumper so they could use it on their podcast.
Yes, I got an email about that, which I need to sit down and do. But I had Stu on Happy Jack's RPG podcast. He read a plug for me. And then I emailed Dan at Fear the Boot. He gave me some constructive criticism and help with starting up, you know, things I need to know, because he's been doing it for 6 years with Fear the Con.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to eventually read a plug for me. Well, they pre-record a whole lot of their shows.
Yeah.
Right.
So eventually it's going to get in there. Hopefully it gets in there before April. But we'll see. I posted on several meetups that are in the Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia area. I posted on a bunch of Yahoo groups, like the Living Forgotten Realms, Virginia Board, and Maryland Board. Well, the Northeast and the Southeast regions. And I made a couple flyers, put them around in local comic book stores, local gaming stores.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I live in
already Virginia. You're way ahead of the guys that ran the local convention here. Because I'll be honest with you, one of the things I never saw, and you know, there's a few game stores, there's not a lot. I mean, granted they're dispersed around the valley, but I never saw a flyer in any of the game stores. And as a matter of fact, this comes to my other question, is that they never even bothered to ask any of the local game stores to come to be vendors.
See, the vendor thing is an issue for us because when we were looking for a venue, we weren't expecting to have people want to be vendors. So it's not in our contract that we can have vendors.
Yeah, commercial selling is a whole other beast for locations.
Well, So you guys aren't doing that. If it's successful, maybe later, maybe in a different convention.
Yes. If we do this again next year, we're going to look at other venues that do offer that. And then what we're doing right now is we're taking like a a donation kind of drive. Mm-hmm. And if anyone wants to donate something to us, next year they will get first, notice about vendor tables.
Mm-hmm.
So that they can, you know, they can get in early and not have to wait in a line if there is a line. I mean,
are you looking at a donation to help offset the costs, or are you looking for giveaways? No,
giveaways. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not asking for any money. We're asking for things that we can give to people who come to our convention.
Cool.
That's very cool. So
we're gonna do a raffle. And one of the incentives is everyone who comes, regardless of pre-registration or not, gets one free ticket in. And then anyone who pre-registers gets two tickets in total. And then if you run a game, any game you run gets you another ticket, and then you can buy extra tickets.
Cool.
Well, that's very cool. So why don't you give us the dates and the location? Well, we're in the show notes. We are going to include the link to the convention page. So,
okay, so we are going to be at the end of April, the 26th through the 28th of 2013, and we are located in Winchester, Virginia, which is the northernmost part of Virginia you can get to before going into West Virginia. So, if you're familiar with the area, we're about an hour and a half outside of D.C., 2 hours south of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, about an hour south of Hagerstown, Maryland. Frederick, Maryland, we're about an hour west, and in Baltimore, we're about an hour and a half.
How far are you from Norfolk?
Norfolk? Oh, my God. About 4 hours.
Okay. Yeah. See, that's the closest I've been to you.
Yeah. Norfolk, Virginia Beach, Norfolk, and all that. Yeah, that's 4 hours away from us.
Still, you know, for some people, that's not a bad drive. That would be a 4 hour drive would be closer for me than, you know, I mean, for some places 4 hours is a heck of a lot easier for me to get to than like going to Gen Con, which me right now is several states away. So,
sure.
But, oh, right. Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, I do feel that James is very spot on in that it does seem that it's kind of dry around here for conventions that are just for gaming. You know, I mean, there are plenty of Comic-Con and Sci-Fi Con stuff where there's also games. But really, in this corridor down here, I mean, I know there's a lot up by Bryan, but once you get down to the Philly and then south for a while, it's pretty dry.
That's kind of the same situation. I mean, my experience has been in Phoenix. Someone who, as far as I know, there isn't any. If there was one, I don't think there is one anymore. Because no one I know can think of one. So, but that's what's here. It's like, you know, we have, you know, like book conventions. And we have, you know, comic conventions. And a lot of times those will have gaming. And in one convention that was kind of a book convention but had gaming, the pass system was very complex and couldn't. It's like I think you needed a doctorate in some sort of strange, you know, badge methodology or something to understand what you needed to buy. Yeah. So
there's a local convention outside of DC called MAGFest, Music and Gaming Convention, or Music and Gaming Fest, and it's mostly for video games and video game music cover bands kind of thing. It's really cool.
That's kind of interesting. Video game music cover bands.
Oh my! I can send you tons of links, and I will if you want them.
That's just
wow. They range from like folk to classical to metal to whatever you want. You know, people just covering video game music.
Wow.
So, all right. But the thing is. When we were there this past year, because it's usually around New Year's, and then this one actually had, for the first time, a big gaming area, like for tabletop and board games, and the place was filled. I could not believe it. It's always been something very small at that convention,
because
it's not their focus, but they opened it up to a much bigger area, and that gave me hope. I was like, oh my gosh, all these people live in this area. Maybe some of them will want to come to my convention. So we've been trying to get the word out to the D.C. and Baltimore area, but that's a little hard because none of us live in those areas. I'm in Virginia, and the rest of them are Pennsylvania.
We'll see what happens, and George will give us a report when he comes back.
I will. So, I totally will.
So speaking of George, George actually had his topic that he wanted to talk about, which was house rules. Kind of give us the rundown of what you were expecting.
Well, yeah, I was. There's a game that I'm not going to name it because I don't feel like dissing anybody today. It's a special day, and I was thinking of playing it, and I thought, well, but I need to house rule this, and I want to house rule that, and then I got this other thing I want to throw in, and before long, you know, I could have a binder of house rules almost as large as the rules themselves, which is of course ridiculous and makes it seem like I'm playing Rifts. So I got.
Riffs.
Yeah, I did this riff. Sorry, the riffs. But
Zach's going to be very displeased.
I'm sure.
Wait a minute. His favorite line is, "Any weapon's cooler as long as you add plasma."
Oh, of course. Anyway, I just started thinking about house rules in general, and I was talking to some of the people I was role playing with about them, and we were kicking around the topic of when house rules are problematic. Right.
Okay.
So I wanted to ask you guys when you think house rules are house rules gone bad. And then I also wanted to share a few house rules that different people shared with me and see if you guys had any favorite house rules from your own houses.
Okay.
So when do they go bad in y'all's general opinion?
You know, I was born in Texas, but I don't use the word y'all. No.
Well, you just did.
That's actually an interesting question. When do I think house rules go bad?
Yeah.
Go ahead. You go ahead.
I would say if I had to use a criteria for a house rule, if a house rule basically is fun for the game master and not the players, or vice versa, then it's probably bad. You know, because if it's a headache for the game master, but it's fun for the players, it's probably not a house rule worth doing just because it's a headache for the game master.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa. If it's something that the game master thinks is all fun and all the players are kind of like, this thing sucks, then you have the inverse problem. You have the mutiny problem.
Mutiny problem, yeah.
So, I mean, that would be my criteria, really, on that.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good criteria. That's it not is. One that I had immediately jumped to. I guess I thought, you know, that's my opinion on everything. If people aren't having fun, there's a problem because we're playing a game. People should be having fun.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
Yeah. Generally, I don't have a problem with house rules because if it works for your game group, I don't care if it doesn't work for me. I'm not going to tell you you're doing it wrong because I don't think you are because it works for your game group. My real problem with house rules is when you forget that they're house rules. When you show up to a convention or you're talking to somebody on the internet and you start telling people that this is how you resolve X situation. Without specifying that this is how I resolve X situation in my home game, but this is not how the rule is actually written. And we can get so used to our house rules that we forget that they're not rules in the game themselves. So people will talk about that sometimes when people start – if someone is a strong proponent of OD&D – a lot of times you'll hear people say, well, which version of OD&D? And they'll say, well, the original one. And I've heard the argument go, oh, you mean the one with the grapple rules? And they say, yeah. They're like, no. It didn't exist in the first three booklets, but it existed for you, and that's how you remember it, which is why you like the X game so much.
Yeah.
But it becomes a problem at conventions sometimes. It's certainly an argument on the internet never has any weight anyway, so I can't say that it's problematic there, but it is annoying. That's just the way it is. You know, nobody plays Monopoly the way it was written.
You know, but I mean that actually is kind of interesting that we have this question in a way, because when I play, you know, back in the dark ages of gaming, you know, I think the assumption was is that the Game Master would house rule a lot of stuff. So anytime, you know, you were talking about, well, people like, well, is that a house rule or not? And I think the assumption was that almost any rule that anyone was talking about at any particular time was probably a house rule, where now mm-hmm. we have the inverse problem where we tend not to house rule as much as we used to, say, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Right? I mean, rules were so sort of streamlined then.
Oh, yeah, trust me.
You were building, yeah, you were building huge parts of what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Trust me, my players are enjoying Gamma World 2nd Edition for that very reason.
That's awesome. Yeah, I saw that blog post. I enjoyed that. yeah, you know, I was really surprised at what some of my players said today when we were talking about this. They said, well, we like how, and this wasn't just games that I DM. This was games that other people DM just in general. They said that they enjoy games, house rules, when they don't have massive effect, when they're, you know, small ripple house rules. And I was shocked because of the number of times where in different games, somebody's house rule actually, you know, dramatically saved a character or something that did mm-hmm. cause a large ripple. You know, even as something as simple as an initiative house rule can, you know, be crucial, right?
Yeah, so absolutely.
I was surprised when they said that. Completely shocked. Although I really did like, you know, I really do like the idea of making sure that if you bring them up early and you get buy-in, you only go with the house rule for as long as everyone's like, yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
You know, the minute two or three of the people are sitting there going, well, I don't know about this anymore, you can break up with it, you know, just like any other rule in the book if you want to.
You know, actually, this is an interesting thing. I was just thinking, you know, speaking of rules, you know, if you really think about it, the original Dragon magazine, every single article was technically somebody's house rule.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, even stuff that we generate for, you know, any other type of, you know, modern gaming magazine, I suppose, unless it's specifically written to be something official, you know, anything that's an option rule is technically a house rule.
Yeah, sure.
So.
Yeah, I mean, I was even thinking about modular games and going like, gee, I wonder why Hero doesn't have too many house rules that you hear about. And then lo and behold, you know, of course they do. That's what all of their advanced players guides are, just house rule upon house rule upon house rule. I don't know why I was even wondering about it. But in regard to house rules and things that are cool, I did start looking around and gathering a small but attractive list of cool house rules. And I was shocked. I feel like I was late to the party that I did not know about the cascading die house rule. And did you guys already know about this?
For which game?
I feel like a dumbass that I wasn't considering the cascading die. Well, I'll explain it. And then if you already knew it, cool. If not, now you do. There's a link in the show notes for it. It's what I sent you earlier, Jeff.
Okay.
It's a way of handling ammo, and I think it's elegant and awesome. Basically works like this. Let's say you have somebody with a bow and arrows, and you don't feel like keeping track of ammo because it's a pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
It works like this. You start out with, say, a D12, and you roll it every time you shoot an arrow. If you roll a 1, the next time you roll, you are rolling a D10. And then if you roll a 1, the next time you are rolling a D8. And you keep going down so that if you get to a D4 and you roll a 1, you are out of arrows.
I like that. It adds a lot of dramatic tension, but you know roughly how far away you are from being empty.
And not only that, but you actually have that little die there on the table
mm-hmm.
to remind you of where you are. So you don't really need a counter. You just go, oh, crap. I rolled a 1 on the D12. Hand me a D10. This is where I am next time I shoot.
That's amazing. I like that. Yeah, no, that's a new one to me. I didn't know about that.
I didn't either. And some other folks were talking about it, and they were like, oh, yeah, it's pretty cool. We should try it, using it for Shadowrun, using it for this. And it does make ammo tracking really both physical and effective.
I could see where that would be really useful in more modern type games.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially I
like the way it feels kind of Savage Worldsy because it's such a simple physical way to handle it. I think that's cool. Anyway, there's a link to that in the show notes for anyone who's interested.
Yeah. Well.
So what about you guys? Do you have any favorite house rules that come to immediate memory?
I mean, a lot of the house rules that I've implemented are very specific to the system.
Yeah.
Because you that's why that you've come up with them. You're sort of trying to patch a hole or make something run smoother. I can think of one off the top of my head that I've applied to multiple systems where I ignore held actions. If you've got an initiative system where you're tracking a specific order, I'm not going to change that order for held actions unless I'm at a convention. You know, I'm talking about my home game here because it's too much work, and I don't think it adds a lot to the game. I don't think it equals out.
Yeah, it is a lot of work.
Yeah, that's my big one. The other one that I like to do is just a very simple +2 or whatever a very basic bonus is in the game. If there's no inherent system for, you know, rewarding creativity on the fly, I will almost always tack one on. You know, you now have an advantage, and whatever it is, apply it to that system. I actually have an article up on the Kobold Press website today where I take that very simple idea and it breaks down into like a full rule system, because I know some people can't run with an idea. They need, like, these are the rules that I have to follow, right. Which is fine. Some people really like to have that structure. So that's up on the Kobold blog today. It's all about running transition scenes for your mechanically minded players. But, I mean, that's all it really is. It's about rewarding somebody with mechanics for doing something that's not mechanical.
I have to agree with that. I played a lot of Exalted, which is a White Wolf game. Mm-hmm. And they have a stunting mechanic where the more descriptive and cooler your actions are, you get stunt dice, and then they also replenish your powers and such like that.
Nice.
So my group, what we do is we try to incorporate that in almost every game we play. For like D&D and Pathfinder, maybe you'll get like a +1 or +2 to your roll extra on top. Other games like Shadowrun and stuff like that will give you extra dice to roll. It's awesome to reward people for their creativity because it makes them want to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm on board with you on that. That's Ooh. Probably one of my favorite house rules, is just pulling mechanics that work in other games and using them almost seamlessly in other games.
You know what? I really do feel like you can use Benny's in almost any game and it's beautiful, so I agree.
You really can.
Exactly.
I don't know why people don't. It blows my mind. Actually, Brian, when you mentioned the article you had up, and when I brought this up earlier, you also shared something you had up. Long story short, somebody wrote in a house rule for D&D 4E that I also thought was awesome. They basically wrote, somebody named Robbie wrote that when a PC rolls to disable a trap.
Oh, I love this rule.
Right?
Yeah.
This is a great rule. This is what Robbie wrote. When a PC rolls to disable a trap, I have them do it in an overturned dice cup. But the roll remains hidden until the other PCs have declared their actions. Only then is the cup removed and the success or failure of the roll revealed. Yeah. How confident are you that the rogue disabled that thrusting spear trap?
Yep.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. So the fighter doesn't know he's got to stride forward or not stride forward. I read that. You know, I found that out the same way you did, by reading the comments on that thread. And that post as well is part of the same series that I wrote my post for. It's called Breaking the Fourth Wall. It's all about sort of adding things to fourth edition. But a lot of things apply to other games too. And I immediately replied back to him that I was stealing that. That's great.
It's awesome, and it's got to yield all kinds of fun results. Here's my new favorite one, all right? I think I mentioned this before, but I will say it. Besides the cascading dice one, because I haven't tried that yet. But I like letting players, let them exchange their initiative rolls or cards or whatever they are,
mm-hmm.
If they choose to.
So really? That,
yeah, if one guy rolls a 3 and the other guy rolls a 15 – and then, you know, they're in the room together, for example, and something's going on, they're allowed to trade. And my logic behind it is that the quicker character might say to the other character, you know, turn, there's a monster right behind you. And his awareness might allow the other person to act first.
Okay.
and it makes for all kinds of fun strategies. My sort of house rule upon that house rule is I only do it if it's a group that's played together for a while, so you can assume that those characters work well as a team, you know, like a soccer team that's practiced for several seasons,
mm-hmm.
or if they are, you know, like some spy group, like they're playing Agents of Oblivion or Delta Green or something, and they would have all been trained operatives to work with other operatives, as opposed to just two guys who met in a bar and decide to go kill goblins, you know?
That's really interesting. I like that. I definitely feel like it's mechanically advantageous.
Yeah,
so it is. In a system that has a lot of mechanics, I would almost want them to pay for that somehow. D&D 3.5 had team feats that you could take to give you like bonuses if you each had the same feat.
Yep.
And I feel like that would work really well there. But in other games that don't have a lot of those mechanical choices, I think I would do just what you do. I'd just let them do it because it's cool.
It's really fun.
Yeah. I mean,
it allows this moment of planning during the initiative stage. It draws out combat, but mm-hmm. it allows these exchanges where they're like, well, but if you do, I will, you'll do that. You promise? Yes, I'll do that. And you know, sometimes it works and sometimes the rogue did not unspring the trap.
It reminds me a lot of Marvel's initiative system, which I love. I know I've talked about it before, where basically you determine who goes first in the round, and then that person chooses who goes next.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
that person chooses who goes next. And you have a lot of control of the flow that way. And it works, so I don't know why it wouldn't work. I can't think yeah. of a good reason why it wouldn't work in Pathfinder. You know?
I will say this. There are moments where players are like, no, I'm not giving up my 19. Screw it.
Sure. And
that's cool, too, you know?
Yep.
So there you have it.
Okay. Well, that's I don't have anything else to add. So
no.
Okay.
So, but what we will do is we'll roll in real quick into the audio comment that we had gotten, which was actually kind of nifty. And let's see what he has to say.
Hi guys. I'm new to tabletop RPG gaming. Well, I haven't really played since I was about 12 years old. And anyway, I'm starting to get back into the hobby and mainly trying to play old school D&D and hopefully eventually try out a few sci-fi games like Shadowrun, Aftermath, or any of the other popular ones. Since I've been back playing, I've played a handful of games. One at my local gaming store, which was a new version of D&D. And then the rest of the time I've been playing online on this website, roll20.net. I'm curious what you think of playing online versus playing in real life. What are the pros and cons of each, and which do you prefer? I know Jeff is kind of a computer nerd and will have an interesting take on this. Thanks, guys, for all the hard work. Love the show. Take care. JP.
Well, that actually... pros and cons. Well, definitely a pro of doing online is you can play with people that cannot necessarily be with you.
mm-hmm.
So that's definitely a pro.
Do you play online, Jeff?
No.
Okay.
The major con that I've had with most online tools, and I have not done the Roll20.net system. But the major problem that I've had is usually the technical aspects of the tool a lot of times are a lot for people to get used to and grasp. So if you have a whole bunch of people who have never used the tool before, it really slows things down. I forget which tool I was using where the Game Master, it was one of those ones that it had a lot of the rules that would be built into the system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were trying to do 4E. So, like, when you cast Magic Missile, it would roll the damage for all the Magic Missiles.
Okay.
And stuff. And we were having technical difficulties with the software because apparently the script extensions weren't working quite correctly. So you actually weren't targeting the right people or something. So it's like ended up having to do all the damage manually anyway.
Sure.
So that is a con of that. One of the pros, and this is going to sound like a weird pro, depending on how you play. For example, I've played a lot of online games, you know, where you've used the, you have, you know, you have the tool, you have character sheets, you have maps, but we're not using voice chat. So it's all text chat.
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds kind of like, well, that's a little weird, you know. Why wouldn't you do voice chat? Well, you know, back in when I originally used to do some of this stuff, you know, voice chat really was not a popular option. Skype wasn't very popular, or, you know, any of the other ones, or they just didn't work very well. But what was interesting about using just straight text chat, especially being an old IRC person that I am, it's interesting that in certain ways you could... I found that, for example, I'm not very good at doing voices. But typing, I can present a character in a certain way that I can't do in person. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a pro for me. You know, so, you know, because obviously, you know, like with the old IRC systems, you can have actions, and it just, I don't know, for me it's more free flowing. When I'm talking sometimes, for me personally, I don't think about stuff, but when I type, I think differently. Does that make any mm-hmm. sense?
No, I think it absolutely does. Yeah.
So in a way, in some cases, if you're playing that way, then you might be using stuff, you know, thought processes that you don't normally use. And you might end up being more creative in written form rather than just playing by speed. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of my pros and cons on it.
When I went to Gen Con, I ran a game for a group of guys. One of them was a backer on the 4E Kickstarter. And these were guys who, you know, used to game with each other because they all lived in the same area. Then people moved away. And they gamed exclusively online now. And they made a decision to do text only live. So they're not doing play by post. They're all on the chat room at the same time, but they're doing text only gameplay. Because they liked the results better, because they could think about what they were writing, and it was more narrative and more descriptive, and more theater of the mind for them that way. So it was easier for them to picture what was going on instead of hearing people talk, and it also really cut down on out of game chatter. So that was really good for them, and they got a chance to play in person in Gen Con, and they really loved it. But it wasn't the same for them. That voice chat didn't recreate that experience for them.
Yeah.
And I think that's totally legitimate. I can tell you that I almost always prefer my real-life group. There's just a real sense of community there. But the nice thing about online gameplay is you can almost find players a lot more easily. At least that's been my experience. Especially now with Google Plus, there are a lot of communities out there that are devoted to specific games or devoted for online play specifically. So if you've always wanted to try Dogs in the Vineyard, you might have a hard time finding people to play it near you, but you're not going to have that hard of a time finding people to play it online.
Now, that's actually a good pro for some of the online gaming mm-hmm. is those lesser known games, especially he mentioned Aftermath.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I haven't heard that one since the 80s.
Yeah, but really. I bet if you jumped on to Google communities and hit the I don't know if there's an Aftermath group, but he could hit the Google Hangout gaming community
and find out if there is one.
He'd find other players. He would.
So
I wonder I've not played an online game, but you know, when he brought up Aftermath, I was also surprised. But because, you know, in my mind, Aftermath is kind of a chunky, you know, sort of mathematic game, at least the way I remembered it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if online games are more comfortable with faster rule game versus clunky rule games, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. The most mechanic heavy game that I've played online is probably D&D 4th edition.
Right,
which to a lot of people is a mechanics heavy game, and it ran very smoothly each time I've done it. But compared to other games, it's mechanics light. It's mechanics heavy compared to a lot of the indie games and the story games right now.
Right.
But I don't know what I would do if I was playing something else. It would definitely take a lot of prep work to make it run smoothly.
I think a lot of it would depend on the actual software being used and the tools available.
Yeah, because when you think about it, a lot of that's not different from at the game table. Math is math.
Well, I'm just thinking that some games like Rollmaster would be heavy
mm-hmm.
to do, or I'm not sure I would want to run a hero game that way.
Sure.
Although, you know, they've kind of did that. I mean, you know, they did have Champions Online, which was, I mean, that was an MMO, but still, you know, effectively you could do something like that, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean,
I wonder about that, though. I just wonder about it because a lot of the rules light game, right? Rules light games have this kind of flexibility and creativity built into the fact that they're a rules light game. Mm-hmm. And that requires one sort of online attitude, whereas a rule booky game, you know, requires a different sort of mindset. Maybe, you know, I mean, you aim for the same amount of fun, and sometimes your rule booky game will be very free, and sometimes your very light game will be very mechanical. But I don't know. I'm just wondering how that would pan out depending on the tool you've got.
Yeah,
I guess you have to shop, right?
I think you've got to try it out and see how things see how things go, because I could see it going poorly. But I could see it going very well, too. That's a good question. I don't have an answer for that.
I don't either.
Right after Christmas, I ran a Pathfinder game on Roll20.net.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, that tool is amazing. Like Jeff, I am a computer guy. I do IT work as a living, all that kind of stuff. I prefer a group that's together. Because it's easier to bounce ideas off of each other that way and just, you know, get into the moment. But with me moving to where I'm at now and all my friends still being in Pennsylvania, online is kind of my way to play now.
Sure.
Yeah, which kind of sucks. But, you know, sometimes I get people to drive down here. But Roll20.net made Pathfinder very easy to run online. It comes with all the tools. You make your own maps. It has dice rollers inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can pull up any image you want off the internet and drop it into the game. It automatically grids. You can just change the size of the grid and all that kind of stuff. I think Roll20.net is going to be where virtual tabletops stay for a little bit. Most also because Tabletop Forge got kind of pushed into that.
Mm-hmm.
They were Google Plus Hangouts, and they decided to change their whole API and go towards Roll20. So there's just a whole lot of stuff out there that work for it, and it's very easy to use. Mm-hmm. I learned how to use it within a day. So.
That's awesome. That's great to know, because I know with 3.5, which is what Pathfinder is based on, of course, that's a very prep heavy game. There's a lot of work that GM needs to do before they get to the game table anyway. So yes. You wouldn't want the tool to be another thing.
Exactly. And I made more work for myself because I did all the maps separately and tried to import them, but the grid didn't really go up with them. But I mm-hmm. found out that if you make the map big enough, you can fog of war the whole thing.
Sure.
And then just show parts that you need. And I was like, you know what? I should have done that from the beginning. It would have made everything so much easier. But
awesome.
I'm a proponent for Roll20.net.
Okay.
And I've also played IRC. So I know yeah. how that is too.
Let me ask, can I ask a quick question about manners then? Because I don't mean to suggest that any of us play with people who are assholes. But
mm-hmm. oh. I do.
My friends are assholes, all of them.
All right. Well, but I mean, I play a lot of – I'm actually addicted to playing online chess, and I have been for years. And as soon as you play online, people are more assholes than they are in real life.
Mm-hmm.
But does that translate to your gaming group?
I've never seen that in the times that I've gamed.
No, I haven't seen that.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Cool.
Yeah.
So.
But I haven't played with complete strangers either.
Right.
I have.
I think it's different because tabletop gaming is such a social experience.
Yeah.
And you want to come back to the same people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, people, you know, also obviously, like, you know, chess has this built-in you versus me competition thing versus build mm-hmm. a story. So there's that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I was just curious.
All right. Well, hopefully we answered JP's question. And hopefully you got some good advice. If not, I apologize, and we'll try to do better next time.
I'm not sorry for it.
That said, if anyone would love to send us any questions, you can do that in a variety of ways. You can email us at info@rpgcircus.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail right now at 1-888-643-6322. That is 1-888-643-6322. You can actually go to our page and click on the link to send us a voicemail, and you launch the SpeakPipe app to record and send us that recording in an email, which is very, very cool, and is probably what we're going to eventually move to here in the next couple of months. Primarily, we're going to get rid of the 888 number. And, of course, you can always find us on Facebook and post something up there, and we'll be more than happy to comment in there as well. So anything before we say goodbye to James?
Everyone go to 1D4Con.
Thank you.
I'm in the wrong side of the country. I'm sorry. But George will be our...
If I could fly you out there and give you a hotel space, I totally would.
Yeah, you know what? Next year. George will be our token.
You can stay at my mom's, Jeff.
No comment.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
All right. James, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about the convention. We really appreciate that, and I hope you enjoyed yourself. And, of course, you know, since you run your 1D4 cast, hopefully some of our listeners... Yeah. Well, I almost forgot what the name of the podcast was. Hopefully some of our listeners will check that out, too, because it's always fun to find additional podcasts to listen to.
Yeah.
Because you always need something to listen to while you're, I don't know, working out, driving, whatever. So... all our listeners, tell your friends that there are podcasts that they can listen to about gaming. So, with that,
thank you, Jeff, for having me on here.
It was
a lot of fun.
I'm glad you enjoyed yourself. So, until 2 weeks from the time that we recorded this, we'll see you. RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.